Bamborough news.
So have I, said Robin, who had managed to swallow the mouthful of brownie. But it isn't good news. Wilma Bayliss's children don't want to talk to us.
The cleaner's kids? Why not?
Wilma wasn't a cleaner by the time she died, Robin reminded him. She was a social worker. Even as she said it, Robin wondered why she felt the need to correct him. Perhaps it was simply that if Wilma Bayliss was to be forever referred to as a cleaner, she, Robin, might as well be forever called the temp.
All right, why don't the social workers' kids want to talk to us? Asked Strike.
The one who called me, Eden, she's the eldest, said they didn't want to drag up what had been a difficult time for the family. She said it had nothing to do with Margot, but then she contradicted herself, because when I said we only wanted to talk about Margot, I can't remember her exact words, but the sense was that talking about Margot's disappearance would involve them talking about the family's personal stuff.
Well, their father was in jail in the early 70s, and Margot was urging Wilma to leave him, said Strike. It's probably that. Think it's worth calling her back, trying a bit more persuasion?
I don't think she's going to change her mind.
And she said she was speaking for her brother and sisters as well?
Yes. One of them's having chemotherapy. She warned me specifically away from her.
Okay, avoid her. But one of the others might be worth a shot.
That'll annoy Eden.
Probably, but we've got nothing to lose now, have we?
Suppose not, said Robin. So what's your news?
The practice nurse and the receptionist, the one who isn't Gloria Conti.
Irene Bull, said Robin.
Irene Bull, now Hickson, exactly. They're both happy to talk to us. Turns out they've been friends since the St. John's practice days. Irene will be delighted to host Janice and us at her house on Saturday afternoon. I think we should both go.
Robin turned her mobile to speakerphone so that she could check the rotor she kept on her phone. The entry for Saturday read, Strike's birthday, TT girlfriend.
I'm supposed to be following two times girlfriend, said Robin, switching back from speakerphone.
Sod that, Morris can do it, said Strike. You can drive us, if you don't mind, he added.
And Robin smiled.
No, I don't mind, she said.
Well, great, said Strike. Enjoy the rest of your day off.
He rang off. Robin picked up the rest of the brownie and finished it slowly, savouring every bite. In spite of the prospect of mediation with Matthew, and doubtless because of a much-needed infusion of chocolate, she felt a good deal happier than she had 10 minutes previously.
Chapter 19. There did I find mine only faithful friend, in heavy plight and sad perplexity, whereof I, sorry, yet myself did bend, him to recomfort with my company. Edmund Spenser, The Faerie Queen.
Strike never told anyone that his birthday was imminent, and avoided announcing it on the day itself. It wasn't that he didn't appreciate people remembering. Indeed, he tended to be far more touched when they did than he ever let show. But he had an innate dislike of scheduled celebration and forced jollity. And of all inane practices, having happy birthday sung to him was one of his least favourites. As far back as he could remember, the day of his birth had brought up unhappy memories on which he chose, usually successfully, not to dwell. His mother had sometimes forgotten to buy him anything when he was a child. His biological father had never acknowledged the date. Birthdays were inextricably linked with the knowledge, which had long since become part of him, that his existence was accidental, that his generic inheritance had been contested in court, and that the birth itself had been, "Fucking hideous, darling. If men had to do it, the human race would be extinct in a year." To his sister Lucy, it would have been almost cruel to let a loved one's birthday pass without a card, a gift, a phone call, or, if she could manage it, a party, or at the very least a meal. This was why he usually lied to Lucy, pretending to have plans so as to avoid having to go all the way out to her house in Bromley and participate in a family dinner that she'd enjoy far more than he would. Not long ago, he'd happily have celebrated with a takeaway at his friends Nick and Isla's, but Isla had suggested Robin accompany Strike, and as Strike had decided many weeks ago that Isla's increasingly open attempts at matchmaking could only be successfully countered by a blanket refusal to cooperate, he'd pretended that he was going to Lucy's instead. The one joyless hope Strike had for his 39th birthday was that Robin would have forgotten it, because, if she did, his own emission would be cancelled out. They'd be quits. He descended the metal stairs to the office on Friday morning and saw, to his surprise, two packages and four envelopes sitting beside the usual pile of mail on Pat's desk. The envelopes were all of different colours. Apparently, friends and family had decided to make sure birthday greetings reached him in time for the weekend.
"Is it your birthday?"
Pat asked in her deep, gravelly voice, still staring at her monitor and typing, electronic cigarette jammed between her teeth as usual.
"Tomorrow," said Strike, picking up the cards.
He recognised the handwriting on three of them, but not the fourth.
"Many happy returns,"
grunted Pat, over the clacking of her keyboard.
"You should have said."
Some spirit of mischief prompted Strike to ask,
"Why? Would you have baked me a cake?"
"No,"
said Pat indifferently.
"Might have got you a card, though."
"Lucky I didn't say, then. One fewer trees died."
"It wouldn't have been a big card,"
said Pat, unsmiling, her fingers still flying over the keyboard. Grinning slightly, Strike removed himself, his cards and packages, into the inner office, and later that evening took them upstairs with him, still unopened. He woke on the 23rd, with his mind full of his trip to Greenwich with Robin later, and only remembered the significance of the day when he saw the presents and cards on the table. The packages contained a sweater from Ted and Joan and a sweatshirt from Lucy. Isla, Dave Polworth and his half-brother Al had all sent joke cards which, while not actually making him laugh, were vaguely cheering. He slipped the fourth card out of its envelope. It had a photograph of a bloodhound on the front, and Strike considered this for a second or two, wondering why it had been chosen. He'd never owned a dog, and while he had a mild preference for dogs over cats, having worked alongside a few in the military, he wouldn't have said dog-loving was one of his salient characteristics. Flicking the card open, he saw the words, "Happy birthday, Cormoran. Best, Johnny. Brackets. Dad." For a few moments, Strike merely looked at the words, his mind as blank as the rest of the card. The last time he'd seen his father's writing, he'd been full of morphine after his leg had been blown off. As a child, he'd occasionally caught a glimpse of his father's signature on legal documents sent to his mother. Then, he'd stared awestruck at the name, as though he were glimpsing an actual part of his father, as though the ink were blood, and solid proof that his father was a real human being, not a myth. Quite suddenly, and with a force that shocked Strike, he found himself full of rage. Rage on behalf of the small boy who would once have sold his soul to receive a birthday card from his father. He'd grown well beyond any desire to have contact with Johnny Rokeby, but he could still recall the acute pain his father's continual and implacable absence had so often caused him as a child. While the primary class was making Father's Day cards, for instance, or when strange adults questioned him about why he never saw Rokeby, or other children jeered at him, singing deadbeat songs, or telling him his mother had got pregnant with him purely to get Rokeby's money. He remembered the longing that was almost an ache, always most acute around birthdays and Christmas, for his father to send something or phone, anything to show that he knew Strike was alive. Strike hated the memory of these fantasies more than he hated remembering the pain caused by their eternal unfulfillment. But most of all, he hated remembering the hopeful lies he'd told himself when, as a very young boy, he'd made excuses for his father, who probably didn't know that the family had moved yet again, who'd sent things to the wrong address, who wanted to know him but simply couldn't find him. Where had Rokeby been when his son was a nobody? Where had Rokeby been every time Leda's life came off the rails and Ted and Joan rode again to the rescue. Where had he been on any of the thousands of occasions when his presence might have meant something real and genuine, rather than an attempt to look good to the papers? Rokeby knew literally nothing about his son, except that he was a detective, and that explained the fucking bloodhound.
Fuck you and your fucking card.
Strike tore the card in half, then into quarters, and threw the pieces into the bin. But for a disinclination to trigger the fire alarm, he might have put a match to them. Anger pulsed like a current through Strike all morning. He hated his own rage, as it showed that Rokeby still had some emotional hold on him. And by the time he set out for Earl's Court, where Robin was picking him up, he was not far off wishing that birthdays had never been invented. Sitting in the Land Rover, just outside the station entrance some 45 minutes later, Robin watched Strike emerge onto the pavement, carrying a leather-bound notebook, and noted that he looked as grumpy as she'd ever seen him.
"Happy birthday," she said, when he opened the passenger door.
Strike immediately noticed the card and the small wrapped package lying on the dashboard.
"Fuck.
Cheers!"
and climbed in beside her, looking even grumpier. As Robin pulled out onto the road, she said,
"Is it turning 39 that's upset you, or has something else happened?"
Having no desire to talk about Rokeby, Strike decided an effort was required.
"No, I'm just knackered. I was up late last night going through the last box of the Bamborough file."
"I wanted to do that on Tuesday, but you wouldn't let me."
"You were old time off," said Strike shortly, tearing open the envelope of her card. "You're still old time off."
"I know, but it would have been a lot more interesting than doing me ironing."
Strike looked down at the front of Robin's card, which featured a watercolour of St. Maur's. She must, he thought, have gone to some trouble to find it in London.
"Nice," he said. "Thanks."
Flipping it open, he read, "Many happy returns. Love, Robin. Kiss." She'd never put a kiss on any message to him before, and he liked it being there. Feeling slightly more cheerful, he unwrapped the small package that accompanied the card and found inside a pair of replacement headphones of the kind Luke had broken while he'd been in St. Maur's over the summer.
"Oh, Robin, that's... thanks. That's great. I hadn't replaced them either."
"I know," said Robin. "I noticed."
As Strike put her card back in its envelope, he reminded himself that he really did need to get her a decent Christmas present.
"Is that Bill Talbot's secret notebook?" Robin asked, glancing sideways at the leather-bound book in Strike's lap.
"The very same. I'll show you after we've talked to Irene and Janice. Batshit crazy. Full of bizarre drawings and symbols."
"What about the last box of police records? Anything interesting?" Robin asked.
"Yes, as it goes. A chunk of police notes from 1975 had got mixed in with a bunch of later stuff. There were a few interesting bits. For instance, the practice cleaner, Wilmer, was sacked a couple of months after Margot disappeared, but for petty theft, not drinking, which is what Gupta told me. Small amounts of money disappearing out of people's purses and pockets. I also found out a call was made to Margot's marital home on Anna's second birthday, from a woman claiming to be Margot."
"Oh my God, that's horrible," said Robin. "A prank call?"
"Police thought so. They traced it to a phone box in Marylebone. Cynthia, the childminder turned second wife, answered. The woman identified herself as Margot and told Cynthia to look after her daughter."
"Did Cynthia think it was Margot?"
"She told police she was too shocked to really take in what the caller said. She thought it sounded a bit like her, but on balance, it sounded more like someone imitating her."
"What makes people do things like that?"
Robin asked, in genuine perplexity.
"They're shits," said Strike. "There were also a bunch of alleged sightings of Margot after the day she disappeared in the last box. They were all disproven, but I've made a list and I'll email them to you. Mind if I smoke?"
"Carry on," said Robin,
and Strike wound down the window.
"I actually emailed you a tiny bit of information last night, too. Very tiny. Remember Albert Shimmings, the local florist?
Whose van people thought they saw speeding away from Clerkenwell Green, yeah. Did he leave a note confessing to murder?
Unfortunately not. But I've spoken to his eldest son, who says that his dad's van definitely wasn't in Clerkenwell at 6:30 that evening. It was waiting outside his clarinet teacher's house in Camden, where his dad drove him every Friday. He says they told the police that at the time. His dad used to wait outside for him in the van and read spy novels.
Well, the clarinet lessons aren't in the records, but both Talbot and Lawson believed Shimmings when they spoke to him. Good to have it confirmed, though, he added, lest Robin think he was being dismissive of her routine work. Well, that means there's still a possibility the van was Dennis Creed's, doesn't it?
Strike lit up a Benson and Hedges, exhaled out of the window, and said,
There was some interesting material on these two women we're about to meet in that last box of notes. More stuff that came out when Lawson took over.
Really? I thought Irene had a dental appointment and Janice had house visits on the afternoon Margot disappeared.
Yeah, that's what their original statement said, said Strike. And Talbot didn't check either woman's story. Took both at their word.
Presumably because he didn't think a woman could be the Essex butcher.
Exactly.
Strike pulled his own notebook out of his coat pocket and opened it to the pages he'd scribbled on Tuesday.
Irene's first statement, which she gave to Talbot, said she'd had a grumbling toothache for a few days before Margot disappeared. Her friend Janice, the nurse, thought it might be an abscess, so Irene made an emergency appointment for 3:00, leaving the practice at 2:30. She and Janice were planning to go to the cinema that evening, but Irene's face was sore and swollen after having a tooth removed, so when Janice phoned her to see how the dentist had gone, and to check whether she still wanted to go out that night, she said she'd rather stay at home.
No mobile phones, mused Robin. Different world.
Exactly what I thought when I was going over this, said Strike. These days Irene's mates would have expected a minute-by-minute commentary, selfies from the dentist's chair. Talbot gave his officers to understand that he'd personally contacted the dentist to check this story, but he hadn't. Wouldn't put it past him to have consulted a crystal ball. Ha ha! I'm not kidding. Wait till you see his notebook.
Strike turned a page.
Anyway, 6 months later, Lawson takes over the case and goes systematically back through every single witness and suspect in the file. Irene told the dentist story again, but 30 minutes after she left him, she panicked and asked to see him again. This time, she admitted she'd lied. There'd never been any tooth pain. She hadn't visited the dentist. She said she'd been forced to do a lot of unpaid overtime at the surgery and resented it, and felt she was owed an afternoon off, so she faked toothache, pretended to have got an emergency appointment, then left the practice and went to the West End to do some shopping. She told Lawson that it was only when she got home, she was still living with her parents, incidentally, that it occurred to her that if she went out to meet Janice, the nurse, that evening, Janice might ask to see the place where the tooth had been extracted, or at least expect to see some swelling. So, when Janice rang her to check they were still going to the cinema, she lied and said she didn't feel up to it. Lawson gave Irene quite a hard time, judging from his notes. Didn't she understand what a serious matter it was, lying to the police? People had been arrested for less, etc. He also put it to her that the news story showed she had no alibi for any point of the afternoon and evening, other than around 6:30 in the evening when Janice rang her at home.
Where did Irene live?
Street called Corporation Row, which, as it happens, lies very close to the Three Kings, though not on the route Margot would have taken from the practice. Anyway, at the point alibis were mentioned, Irene became hysterical. She poured out a load of stuff about Margot having a lot of enemies without being able to say who these enemies were, although she referred Lawson back to the anonymous letters Margot received. The next day, Irene went back to Lawson yet again, this time accompanied by her very angry father, who did her no favours by losing his temper at Lawson for daring to upset his daughter. In the course of this third interview, Irene presented Lawson with a receipt from Oxford Street, which was marked 3:10 p.m. on the day Margot disappeared. The receipt was for cash. Lawson probably took a lot of pleasure in telling Irene and her dad that all the receipt proved was that somebody had gone shopping on Oxford Street that day. Still, a receipt for the right day, right time. Could have been her mother's, a friend's. Why would they have kept it for 6 months? Why would she? Robin considered the matter. She regularly kept receipts, but these were matters of expenses while doing surveillance to be presented to the accountant.
Yeah, maybe it is odd she still had it, she conceded.
But Lawson never managed to get anything further out of her. I don't think he genuinely suspected her, mind you. I get the impression he just didn't like her. He pressed her very hard on the anonymous notes she claimed to have seen, the ones mentioning hellfire. I don't think he believed in them.
I thought the other receptionist confirmed she'd seen one.
She did. Nothing to say they weren't in cahoots, though. No trace of the notes was ever found.
But that'd be a serious lie, said Robin. With a fake dental appointment, I can see why she fibbed and why she'd have been frightened to admit it afterwards. Lying about anonymous notes in the context of a missing person, though.
Ah, but don't forget, Irene was already telling the story of the anonymous notes before Margot went missing. It's more of the same, isn't it? The two receptionists could have invented these threatening notes for the pleasure of starting a malicious rumour, then found it impossible to back away from the lie after Margot disappeared. Anyway, said Strike, flicking over a couple of pages, so much for Irene. Now for her best buddy, the practice nurse. Janice's original statement was that she drove around all afternoon making house calls. The last visit, which was to an old lady with multiple health issues, kept her longer than she expected. She left there around 6 and hurried straight to a call box to ring Irene at home to see whether they were still on for the cinema that evening. Irene said she didn't feel up to it, but Janice had already got herself a babysitter and was desperate to see the movie, James Caan, The Gambler, so she went anyway. Watched the movie alone, then went back to the neighbours, picked up her son, and went home. Talbot didn't bother to check any of this, but a zealous junior officer did, on his own initiative, and it all checked out. All the patients confirmed that Janice had been at their houses at the right times. The babysitter confirmed that Janice returned to pick up her son when expected. Janice also produced a half-torn ticket for the movie out of the bottom of her handbag. Given that this was less than a week after Margot disappeared, it doesn't seem particularly fishy, her still having it. On the other hand, a torn ticket is no more proof that she sat through the movie than the receipt is proof Irene went shopping. He threw his cigarette end out of the window. "Where did Janice's last patient of the day live?" asked Robin, and Strike knew that her mind was running on distances and timings. "Gopsall Street, which is about a 10-minute drive from the practice. It would have been just possible for a woman in a car to have intercepted Margot on the way to the Three Kings, assuming Margot was walking very slowly, or was delayed somewhere along the route, or left the practice later than Gloria said she did. But it would have required luck, because as we know, some of the path Margot would have taken was pedestrianized.
And I can't really see why you'd make arrangements with a friend to go to the cinema if you were planning to abduct someone, said Robin.
Nor can I, said Strike, but I'm not finished. When Lawson takes over the case, he finds out that Janice lied to Talbot as well.
You're kidding?
Nope. Turns out she didn't actually have a car. 6 weeks before Margot disappeared, Janice's ancient Morris Minor gave up the ghost and she sold it for scrap. From that time onwards, she was making all her house calls by public transport and on foot. She hadn't wanted to tell anyone at the practice that she was carless in case they told her she couldn't do her job. Her husband had walked out, leaving her with a kid. She was saving up to get a new car, but she knew it was going to take a while, so she pretended the Morris Minor was in the garage, or that it was easier to get the bus, if anyone asked.
But if that's true...
It is. Lawson checked it all out, questioned the scrapyard and everything.
Then that surely puts her completely out of the frame for an abduction.
I'm inclined to agree, said Strike. She could have got a cab, of course, but the cabbie would have had to be in on the abduction too. No. The interesting thing about Janice is that in spite of believing she was entirely innocent, Talbot interviewed her a total of 7 times, more than any other witness or suspect.
7 times?
Yep. He had a kind of excuse at first. She was a neighbour of Steve Douthwaite's, Margot's acutely stressed patient. Interviews 2 and 3 were all about Douthwaite, who Janice knew to say hello to. Douthwaite was Talbot's preferred candidate for the Essex Butcher, so you can follow his thought processes. You would question neighbours if you thought someone might be butchering women at home. But Janice wasn't able to tell Talbot anything about Douthwaite beyond what we already know. And Talbot still kept going back to her. After the 3rd interview, he stopped asking her about Douthwaite, and things got very strange indeed. Among other things, Talbot asked whether she'd ever been hypnotized, whether she'd be prepared to try it, asked her all about her dreams, and urged her to keep a diary of them so he could read it, and also to make him a list of her most recent sexual partners.
He did what?
There's a copy of a letter from the commissioner in the file, said Strike dryly, apologizing to Janice for Talbot's behavior. All in all, you can see why they wanted him off the force as fast as possible.
Did his son tell you any of that?
Strike remembered Gregory's earnest, mild face, his assertion that Bill had been a good father, and his embarrassment as the conversation turned to pentagrams.
I doubt he knew about it. Janice doesn't seem to have made a fuss.
Well, said Robin slowly, she was a nurse. Maybe she could tell he was ill.
She considered the matter for a few moments, then said, It'd be frightening, though, wouldn't it? Having the investigating officer coming back to your house every 5 minutes, asking you to keep a dream diary.
It'd put the wind up most people. I'm assuming the explanation is the obvious one, but we should ask her about it.
Strike glanced into the back and saw, as he'd hoped, a bag of food.
Well, it is your birthday, said Robin, her eyes still on the road.
Fancy a biscuit?
Bit early for me. You carry on.
As he leaned back to fetch the bag, Strike noticed that Robin smelled again of her old perfume. Chapter 20 And if that any ill she heard of any, she would it eke, and make much worse by telling, and take great joy to publish it to many, that every matter worse was for her melling. Edmund Spenser, The Fairy Queen. Irene Hickson's house lay in a short, curving Georgian terrace of yellow brick, with arched windows and fanlights over each black front door. It reminded Robin of the street where she'd spent the last few months of her married life, in a rented house that had been built for a sea merchant. Here, too, were traces of London's trading past. The lettering over an arched window read, Royal Circus Tea Warehouse.
Mr. Hickson must have made good money, said Strike, looking up at the beautifully proportioned frontage as he and Robin crossed the street. This is a long way from Corporation Row.
Robin rang the doorbell. They heard a shout of,
Don't worry, I'll get it.
And a few seconds later, a short, silver-haired woman opened the door to them. Dressed in a navy sweater and trousers of the kind that Robin's mother would have called slacks, she had a round pink and white face. Blue eyes peeked out from beneath a blunt fringe that Robin suspected she might have cut herself.
"Mrs. Hickson?" asked Robin.
"Janice Beattie," said the older woman. "You're Robin, are you? And you're..."
The retired nurse's eyes swept down over Strike's legs in what looked like professional appraisal.
"Cormoran, is that how you say it?"
she asked,
looking back up into his face.
"That's right," said Strike. "Very good of you to see us, Mrs. Beatty."
"Oh, no trouble at all," she said, backing away to let them in. "Irene'll be with us in a mo."
The naturally upturned corner of the nurse's mouth and the dimples in her full cheeks gave her a cheerful look, even when she wasn't smiling. She led them through a hall that Strike found oppressively over-decorated. Everything was dusty pink. The flowered wallpaper, the thick carpet, the dish of potpourri that sat on the telephone table. The distant sound of a flush told them exactly where Irene was. The sitting room was decorated in olive green, and everything that could be swagged, flounced, fringed or padded had been. Family photographs in silver frames were crowded on side tables, the largest of which showed a heavily tanned 40-something blonde who was cheek-to-cheek over fruit and umbrella-laden cocktails with a florid gentleman who Robin assumed was the late Mr. Hickson. He looked quite a lot older than his wife. A large collection of porcelain figurines stood upon purpose-built mahogany shelves against the shiny olive-green wallpaper. All represented young women. Some wore crinolines, others twirled parasols, still others sniffed flowers or cradled lambs in their arms.
"She collects them," said Janice, smiling as she saw where Robin was looking. "Lovely, aren't they?"
"Oh, yes," lied Robin. Janice didn't seem to feel she had the right to invite them to sit down without Irene present, so the three of them remained standing beside the figurines.
"Have you come far?"
she asked them politely. But before they could answer, a voice that commanded attention said,
"Hello! Welcome!"
Like her sitting room, Irene Hickson presented a first impression of over-embellished, over-padded opulence. Just as blonde as she'd been at 25, she was now much heavier, with an enormous bosom. She'd outlined her hooded eyes in black, penciled her sparse brows into a high, Pierrot-ish arch, and painted her thin lips in scarlet. In a mustard-coloured twin set, black trousers, patent heels, and a large quantity of gold jewellery, which included clip-on earrings so heavy they were stretching her already long lobes, she advanced on them in a potent cloud of amber perfume and hairspray.
"How d'you do?" she said, beaming at Strike as she offered a hand, bracelets jangling. "Has Jan told you what happened this morning? So strange with you coming today. So strange, but I've lost count of the number of times things like that happen to me."
She paused, then said dramatically,
"My Margot shattered. My Margot Fontaine on the top shelf," she said, pointing to a gap in the china figurines, "fell apart into a million pieces when I ran the feather duster over her."
She paused, waiting for astonishment.
"That is odd," said Robin, because it was clear Strike wasn't going to say anything.
"Isn't it?" said Irene. "Tea, coffee, whatever you want." "I'll do it, dear," said Janice. "Thank you, my love. Maybe make both," said Irene.
She waved Strike and Robin graciously towards armchairs.
"Please, sit down."
The armchairs placed Strike and Robin within view of a window framed in tasseled curtains, through which they could see a garden with intricate paving and raised beds. It had an Elizabethan air, with low box hedges and a wrought-iron sundial.
"Oh, the garden was all my Eddie," said Irene,
following their gaze.
"He loved his garden, bless his heart. Loved this house. It's why I'm still here, although it's too big for me now, really. Excuse me, I haven't been well," she added in a loud whisper,
making quite a business of lowering herself onto the sofa and placing cushions carefully around herself.
"Jan's been a saint."
"I'm sorry to hear that," said Strike. "That you've been unwell, I mean, not your friend's a saint."
Irene gave a delighted peal of laughter, and Robin suspected that if Strike had been sitting slightly nearer, Irene might have playfully cuffed him. With an air of giving Strike privileged information, she half-mouthed,
"Irritable bowel syndrome. It flares up.
The pain is sometimes, well, the funny thing is, I was fine all the time I was away. I've been staying with my eldest daughter. They're in Hampshire. That's why I didn't get your letter straight away. But the moment I got home, I called Jan. I said, you'll have to come. I'm in that much pain, and my GP's no use, she added, with a little moo of disgust. Woman, all my own fault, according to her. I should be cutting out everything that makes life worth living. I was telling them, Jan, she said, as her friend backed into the room with a laden tea tray, that you're a saint. Oh, carry on. Everyone likes a good review, said Janice cheerfully.
Strike was halfway out of his chair to help her with the tray, on which stood both teapot and cafetière, but like Mrs. Gupta, she refused help, depositing it on a padded ottoman. An assortment of chocolate biscuits, some foil-wrapped, lay on a doily. The sugar bowl had tongs, and the flowered fine-bone china suggested for best. Janice joined her friend on the sofa and poured out the hot drinks, serving Irene first.
"Help yourself to biscuits,"
Irene told her visitors, and then, eyeing Strike hungrily.
"So, the famous Cameron Strike. I nearly had a heart attack when I saw your name at the bottom of the letter. And you're going to try and crack Creed, are you? Will he talk to you, do you think? Will they let you go and see him?"
"We're not that far along yet," said Strike with a smile, as he took out his notebook and uncapped his pen. "We've got a few questions, mainly background, that you two might be able—"
"Oh, anything we can do to help," said Irene eagerly. "Anything."
"We've read both your police statements," said Strike. "So unless—"
"Oh, dear,"
interrupted Irene, pulling a mock fearful expression.
"You know all about me being a naughty girl, then? About the dentist and that, do you? There'll be young girls out there doing it right now, fibbing to get a few hours off. But just my luck I picked the day Margot—" "Sorry, I don't mean that,"
Irene said, catching herself.
"I don't. This is how I get myself in trouble," she said, with a little laugh. "Steady, girl," Eddie would have said, "wouldn't he, Jan?" she said, tapping her friend on the arm. "Wouldn't he have said, steady, girl?"
"He would,"
said Janice, smiling and nodding.
"I was going to say," Strike continued, "that unless either of you have got anything to add—"
"Oh, don't think we haven't thought about it," interrupted Irene again. "If we'd remembered anything else, we'd have been straight down the police station, wouldn't we, Jan? I'd like to clarify a few points."
"Mrs. Beatty," said Strike, looking at Janice, who was absent-mindedly stroking the underside of her wedding ring, which was the only piece of jewellery she wore. "One thing that struck me when I read the police notes was how many times Inspector Talbot—"
"Oh, you and me both, Cameron,"
Irene interrupted eagerly, before Janice could open her mouth.
"You and me both. I know exactly what you're going to ask. Why did he keep pestering Jan? I told her at the time, didn't I, Jan? I said, this isn't right, you should report it, but you didn't, did you? I mean, I know he was having a breakdown, blah, blah, blah. You all know all about that," she said with a nod towards Strike,
that simultaneously conveyed a compliment and an eagerness to fill him in should he require it.
"But ill men are still men, aren't they?"
"Mrs. Beatty," repeated Strike slightly louder, "why do you think Talbot kept interviewing you?"
Irene took the broad hint and allowed Janice to answer. But her self-restraint lasted only until Janice hit her stride, at which point she set up a murmured counterpoint, echoing Janice's words, adding agreement and emphasis, and giving the general impression that she feared that if she did not make a noise every few seconds, Strike might forget she was there.
"I dunno, in all honesty," said Janice, still fiddling with her wedding ring. "The first few times he saw me, it was straightforward questions." "At first it was, yeah,"
murmured Irene, nodding along.
"About what I done that day, you know, what I could tell him about people coming to see Margot, because I knew a lot of the patients. We got to know them all working at the practice," said Irene, nodding. "But then it was like he thought I had, well, special powers.
I know that sounds bonkers, but I don't think...
Oh, well, I do, said Irene, her eyes on Strike.
No, I honestly don't think he was... You know...
Janice seemed embarrassed even to say it.
Keen on me. He did ask inappropriate things, but I could tell he wasn't right, you know, in the head. It was an horrible position to be in, honestly, Janice said, switching her gaze to Robin. I didn't feel like I could tell anyone. He was police. I just had to keep sitting there while he asked me about me dreams. And after the first few interviews, that's all he wanted to talk about. Me past boyfriends and stuff. Nothing about Margot or the patients.
He was interested in one patient, or wasn't, began Robin.
Duckworth,
piped up Irene excitedly.
Douthwaite, said Strike.
Douthwaite, yes, that's who I meant, muttered Irene.
And to cover a slight embarrassment, she helped herself to a biscuit, which meant that for a few moments at least, Janice was able to talk uninterrupted.
"Yeah, he did ask me about Steve," said Janice, nodding, "'cause he lived in my block of flats down Percival Street.'
"'Did you know Douthwaite well?' asked Robin.
"'Not really. Actually, I never knew him at all until he got beaten up. "'I come home late and found a load of people on the landing with him. "'People knew I was a nurse, so there's me with my son Kevin under one arm and shopping in the other hand.' But Steve was in a right state, so I had to help. He didn't want the police called, but he'd had the sort of beating that can leave you with internal injuries. The other geezer had used a bat. Jealous husband. Who had completely the wrong end of the stick, didn't he?
Interrupted Irene.
Because Douthwaite was queer,
she said, with a shout of laughter.
He was only friends with the wife, but this jealous idiot thinks... Well... "'I don't know if Steve was queer,' began Janice.
But there was no stopping Irene.
"'Man, woman, two and two make five. My Eddie was exactly the same. Jan, bear me out. What was Eddie like?'
she said, tapping Janice's arm again.
"'Exactly the same, wasn't he? I remember once I said, "'Eddie, you think if I so much look at a man, he can be queer, he can be Welsh. But after you told me, Jan, I thought, yeah.' That Duckworth, Douthing, is a bit camp. When he came in the surgery afterwards, I could see it. Good-looking, but a bit soft. But I don't know whether he was queer, Irene. I didn't know him well enough to... He kept coming back to see you,
Irene chided her.
You told me he did. Kept coming back to your place for tea and sympathy and telling you all his problems. It were only a couple of times, said Janice. We'd chat, passing on the stairs, and one time he helped me with my shopping and come in for a cup of tea. "'But he asked you,'
prompted Irene.
"'I'm getting to that, dear,' said Janice,
with what Strike thought was remarkable patience.
"'He was getting headaches,' she told Strike and Robin, "'and I told him he needed to go and see a doctor for headaches. "'I couldn't diagnose him. "'I mean, I felt a bit sorry for him.' But I didn't want to get in the habit of holding out-of-hours clinics in me flat. I had Kevin to look after.
So you think Douthwaite's visits to Margot was because of his health? Asked Robin. Not because he had a romantic interest in.
He did send her chocolates one time, said Irene. But if you ask me, it was more like she was an agony aunt. Well, he had these head pains and he was definitely nervous. Depressed, maybe. Said Janice. Everyone had blamed him for what happened to that poor girl who killed herself, but I don't know. And some of me other neighbours told me they were young men coming in and out of his flat. There you are,
said Irene triumphantly.
Queer. Might not have been that, said Janice. Could have just been his mates, or drugs, or stuff falling off the back of a lorry. One thing I do know, 'cause people talked locally. The husband of that girl who killed herself was knocking 12 bells out of her. Tragedy, really. But the papers pinned it all on Steve, and he ran. Well, sex sells better than domestic violence, doesn't it? If you find Steve, she added, tell him I said hello. It wasn't fair what the papers did.
Robin had been trained by Strike to organise her interviews and notes into categories of people, places and things. She now asked both women, "Were there any other patients you can ever remember giving cause for alarm at the practice? Or perhaps having an unusual relationship with Mark?"
"Well," said Irene, "remember, Jan, there was that one with the beard down to here." She placed her hand at waist level. "Remember? What was he called? Apton? Applethorpe? Jan, you remember? You do remember, Jan. He stank like a tramp and you had to go round his house once. He used to wander around near St. John's. I think he lived on Clerkenwell Road. Sometimes he had his kid with him. Really funny-looking kid. Massive ears." "Oh, them," said Janice, her frown disappearing. "But they weren't Margot's. Well, he was stopping people on the street afterwards, telling them he'd killed Margot," Irene told Strike excitedly. "Yeah, he was. He stopped Dorothy. Of course, Dorothy wasn't going to tell the police, not Dorothy. She was all load of stuff and nonsense. He's a lunatic. But I said to her, 'What if he actually did do it, Dorothy, and you haven't told anyone?' Now, Applethorpe was a proper nutcase. He had a girl locked up." "She weren't locked up, Irene," said Janice, for the first time showing a trace of impatience. "Social work said she were agoraphobic, but she weren't being kept there against her will." "She was peculiar," said Irene stubbornly. "You told me she was. I think someone should have taken the kid away, personally. You said the flat was filthy. You can't take people's children off them because they haven't cleaned the house," said Janice firmly. She turned back to Strike and Robin. "Yeah, I visited the Applethorpes just the once, but I don't think they ever met Margot. See, it was different then. Doctors had their own lists, and the Applethorpes were registered with Brenner. He asked me to go round for him, check on the kid."
"Do you remember the address, street name?"
"Oh, Gould," said Janice, frowning. "Yeah, I think it was Clerkenwell Road. I think so. See, I only visited the once. The kid hadn't been well, and Dr. Brenner wanted him checked, and he'd never make an house call if he could avoid it. Anyway, the kid was on the mend, but I spotted right off the dad was..."
"Nutcase," said Irene, nodding along.
"Jittery. Bit out of it," said Janice. "I went in the kitchen to wash me hands, and there was a load of Benzedrine lying in full view on the worktop. I warned both the parents, now the kid was walking, to put it somewhere safe."
"Really funny-looking kid," interposed Irene.
"And I went to Brenner after, and I said, 'Dr. Brenner, that man's abusing Benzedrine.' It was proper addictive. We all knew it by then, even in 74. Of course, Brenner thought I was being presumptuous, querying his prescriptions. But I was worried. So I called social work without telling Brenner, and they were very good. They were already keeping a close eye on the family."
"But the mother," said Irene.
"You can't decide for other people what makes them happy, Irene," said Janice. "The mum loved that kid, even if the dad was, well, he was odd, poor sod," Janice conceded. "He thought he was a kind of, I don't know what you call it, a guru or a magic man. Thought he could put the evil eye on people. He told me that during the house call. You do meet people with weird ideas, nursing. I just used to say, 'Really? How interesting.' There's no point challenging them. But Applethorpe thought he could ill-wish people. That's what we used to call it in the old days. He was worried his little boy had got German measles because he got cross with him. He said he could do that to people. He died himself, poor sod, year after Margot vanished."
"Did he?" said Irene, with a trace of disappointment.
"Yeah, it would have been after you left, after you married Eddie. I remember street cleaners found him early in the morning, curled up and dead under the Walter Street Bridge. Heart attack. Keeled over, and there was nobody there to help him. Wasn't that old, neither. I remember Dr. Brenner being a bit twitchy about it."
"Why was that?" asked Strike.
Well, he prescribed the bennies the man was abusing, hadn't he?
To Robin's surprise, a fleeting smile passed over Strike's face.
But it weren't just Applethorpe, Janice went on,
who didn't seem to have noticed anything odd in Strike's response.
There was, oh, tons of people swore blind they'd heard something or had a hunch, blah, 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 said Irene, rolling her eyes. And there were us, you know, who were actually involved. It was terrible, just...
Excuse me, she said, putting her hand on her stomach.
I must just nip to the... Sorry.
Irene left the room in something of a hurry. Janice looked after her, and it was hard, giving her naturally smiley face, to tell whether she was more concerned or amused.
She'll be fine, she told Strike and Robin quietly. I have told her the doc's probably right, telling her to lay off the spicy food, but she wanted a curry last night. She gets lonely, rings me up to come over. I stayed overnight. Eddie only died last year, nearly 90, bless him. He adored Irene and the girls. She misses him something rotten.
Were you about to tell us somebody else had claimed to know what happened to Margot? Strike prompted her gently.
What? Oh, yeah, Charlie Ramage. He had an hot tub and sauna business. Wealthy man, so you'd think he had better things to do with his time than make up stories. But there you go. People are funny.
What did he say? Asked Robin.
Well, see, motorbikes were Charlie's hobby. He had loads of them, and he used to go on these long rides all over the country. He had a bad smash, and he was at home with two broken legs, so I was dropping in several times a week. This would have been a good 2 years after Margot disappeared. Well, Charlie was a man who liked to talk, and one day, out of a clear blue sky, he swears blind he met Margot about a week after she went missing in Leamington Spa. But you know, Janice said, shaking her head, I didn't take it very serious. Lovely man, but like I say, he liked to talk.
What exactly did he tell you? Asked Robin.
Said he'd been on one of his bike trips up north, and he stopped outside this big church in Leamington Spa, and he was leaning against the wall having a cup of tea and a sandwich, and there was this woman walking in the graveyard on the other side of the railings, looking at the graves. Not like she was in mourning or anything, just interested. Black hair, according to Charlie. And he called out to her, nice place, innit? And she turned to look at him and, well, he swore blind it was Margot Bamborough, with her hair dyed. He said he told her she looked familiar, and she looked upset and hurried off.
And he claimed this happened a week after she disappeared? Asked Robin.
Yeah, he said he recognised her because her picture was still all over the papers at the time. So I says, did you go to the police about this, Charlie? And he says, yeah, I did. And he told me he was friends with a policeman, quite an eye-up bloke, and he told his friend. But I never saw or heard anything about it after, you know.
Ramage told you this story in 1976, Strike asked, making a note.
Yeah, must have been,
said Janice, frowning in an effort to remember, as Irene walked back into the room.
Because they got Creed by then. That's how it came up. He'd been reading about the trial in the papers, and then he says, cool as you like. Well, I don't think he'd done anything to Margot Bamborough, because I reckon I seen her after she disappeared.
Did Margot have any connection with Leamington Spa, as far as you know? Asked Robin.
What's this? Asked Irene sharply.
Nothing, said Janice. Just a stupid story some patient told me. Margot in a graveyard with dyed hair. You know.
In Leamington Spa?
Said Irene, looking displeased.
Robin had the impression that she greatly resented having left Janice in the spotlight while she was forced back to the bathroom.
You never told me that. Why didn't you tell me?
Oh, well, it was in 76, said Janice, looking slightly cowed. You must have just had Sharon. You had better things to think about than Charlie Ramage telling porkies.
Irene helped herself to another biscuit
frowning slightly. "I'd like to move on to the practice itself," said Strike. "How did you find Margot to work with?" said Irene loudly, who seemed to feel it was her turn, having missed out on several minutes of Strike's attention.
"Well, speaking personally..."
Her pause was that of an epicure, savouring the prospect of coming pleasure. "To be totally honest, she was one of those people who think they know best about everything. She'd tell you how to live your life, how to do the filing, how to make a cup of tea, blah, blah, blah." "Oh, Irene, she weren't that bad," muttered Janice.
"I liked..." "Jan, come on," said Irene loftily. "She never got over being the clever clogs in her family and thought all the rest of us were thick as mints."
"Well, maybe she didn't think you were," said Irene, with an eye roll, as her friend shook her head.
"But she did me. Treated me like a moron. Patronising, isn't it? Now, I didn't dislike her," Irene added quickly. "Not dislike, but she was picky. Very pleased with herself. We'd completely forgotten we came from a two-up, two-down in Stepney. Put it that way."
"How did you find her?" Robin asked Janice.
"Well..."
began Janice, but Irene talked over her.
"Snobby, Jan, come on. She marries herself a rich consultant. That was no two-up, two-down, that place out in Ham. Proper eye-opener it was. Seeing what she'd married into, and then she has the gall to come to work preaching the liberated life to the rest of us. Marriage isn't the be-and-end-all, don't stop your career, blah, 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 and always finding fault. What did she... how you answered the phone, how you spoke to patients, how you dressed, even. Irene, I don't think that top's appropriate for work. She was a bloody bunny girl. The hypocrisy of her. I didn't dislike her," Irene insisted. "I didn't, truly. I'm just trying to give you the full... Oh, and she wouldn't let us make her hot drinks, would she, Jan? Neither of the other two doctors ever complained we didn't know what to do with a tea bag." "That's not why..." began Janice. "Jan, come on. You remember how fussy...
Why would you say she didn't like people making her drinks?" Strike asked Janice. Robin could tell that his patience was wearing thin with Irene.
"Oh, that was 'cause of when I was washing up mugs one day," said Janice. "I tipped the dregs out of Dr. Brenner's and I found an..." "Atomal pill, wasn't it?" asked Irene. "Amital capsule stuck to the bottom. I knew what it was from the colour."
"Blue," interjected Irene, nodding,
"weren't they?" "Blue Evans, they used to call them on the street, yeah," said Janice. "Downers. I always made sure everyone knew I didn't have nothing like that in me nurse's bag when I was out making house calls. You had to be careful, in case you got mugged."
"How did you know it was Dr. Brenner's cup?" asked Strike.
"He always used the same one, with his old university's coat of arms on," said Janice. "There'd have been hell to pay if anyone else touched it."
She hesitated.
"I don't know whether... if you've talked to Dr. Gupta."
"We know Dr. Brenner was addicted to barbiturates," Strike said. Janice looked relieved.
"Right, well, I knew he must have dropped it in there accidental when he was taking some. Probably didn't realise, thought it had rolled away on the floor. There'd have been a lot of questions asked. Usually at a doctor's surgery, finding drugs in a drink. If something gets into someone's tea by accident, that's serious."
"How much harm would a single capsule..." Robin began.
"Oh, no real harm," said Irene knowledgeably. "Would it, Jan?" "No, a single capsule, that's not even a full dose," said Janice. "You'd have felt a bit sleepy, that's all. Anyway, Margot come out the back to make the tea when I was trying to get the pill off the bottom of the mug with a teaspoon. We had a sink and a kettle and a fridge just outside the nurse's room. She saw me trying to scrape the pill out. So it weren't fussiness, making her own drinks after that. It were precautionary. I took extra care to make sure I was drinking out of me own mug as well."
"Did you tell Margot how you thought the pill had got in the tea?" asked Robin.
"No," said Janice, because Dr. Gupta had asked me not to mention Brenner's problem, so I just said, must have been an accident, which was technically true. I expected her to call a staff meeting and hold an inquiry. Ah, well, you know my theory about why she didn't do that, said Irene.
Irene, said Janice, shaking her head, honestly,
my theory, said Irene, ignoring Janice, is Margot thought someone else had put the pill in Brenner's drink. And if you're asking me who,
Irene,
said Janice again, clearly urging restraint. But Irene was unstoppable.
I'll tell you, Gloria, that girl was rough as hell, and she came from a criminal background. No, I'm saying it, Jan. I'm sure Cameron wants to know everything what was going on at that practice. How can Gloria put in something in Brenner's tea? And by the way, Janice said to Strike and Robin, I don't think she did.
Well, as I was on the desk with Gloria every day, Jan, said Irene loftily, I knew what she was really like. But even if she did put the pill in his tea, Irene, how could that have anything to do with Margot disappearing?
I don't know, said Irene, who seemed to be getting cross. But they're interested in who was working there and what went on, aren't you?
She demanded of Strike, who nodded. With a see? To Janice, Irene plunged on. So, Gloria came from a really rough family, a Little Italy family. Janice tried to protest, but Irene overrode her again.
She did, Jan. One of the brothers was drug dealing, that sort of thing. She told me so. That Atomol capsule might not have come from Brenner's store at all. She could have got it off one of her brothers. Gloria hated Brenner. He was a miserable old sod, all right, always having a go at us. She said to me once, imagine living with him. If I was his sister, I'd poison the old bastard's food. And Margot heard her and told her off, because there were patients in the waiting room and it wasn't professional, saying something like that about one of the doctors. Anyway, when Margot never did anything about the pill in Brenner's mug, I thought, that's because she knows who did it. She didn't want her little pet in trouble. Gloria was her project, see? Gloria spent half her time in Margot's consulting room being lectured on feminism while I was left to hold the fort on reception. She'd have let Gloria get away with murder, Margot would. Total blind spot.
Do either of you know where Gloria is now? Asked Strike.
No idea. She left not long after Margot disappeared, said Irene.
I never saw her again after she left the practice, said Janice, who looked uncomfortable.
But, Irene, I don't think we should be flinging accusations.
Do me a favour, said Irene abruptly to her friend, a hand on her stomach.
And fetch that medicine off the top of the fridge for me, will you? I'm still not right. And would anyone like more tea or coffee while Jan's there?
Janice got up uncomplainingly, collected empty cups, loaded the tray, and set off for the kitchen. Robin got up to open the door for her, and Janice smiled at her as she passed. While Janice's footsteps padded away down the thickly carpeted hall, Irene said, unsmiling,
"Poor Jan. She's had an awful life, really. Like something out of Dickens, her childhood. Eddie and I helped her out financially a few times, after BT left her. She calls herself BT, but he never married her, you know," said Irene. "Awful, isn't it? And they had a kid, too. I don't think he ever really wanted to be there. And then he walked out. Larry, though. I mean, he wasn't the brightest tool in the box." Irene laughed a little. "But he thought the world of her. I think she thought she could do better at first. Larry worked for Eddie, you know. Not on the management side, he was just a builder. But in the end, I think she realised, well, you know, not everyone's prepared to take on a kid.
Could I ask you about the threatening notes to Margot you saw, Mrs. Hickson?"
"Oh, yes, of course," said Irene, pleased. "So you believe me, do you? Because the police didn't."
"There were two, you said in your statement."
"That's right. I wouldn't have opened the first one, only Dorothy was off and Dr. Brenner told me to sort out the post. Dorothy was never off, usually. It was because her son was having his tonsils out. Spoiled little so-and-so he was. That was the only time I ever saw her upset, when she told me she was taking him into hospital the next day. Hard as nails, usually. But she was a widow, and he was all she had."
Janice reappeared with refilled teapot and cafetiere.
Robin got up and took the heavy teapot and cafetière off the tray for her. Janice accepted her help with a smile and whispered, "Thanks," so that she didn't interrupt Irene.
"What did the note say?" Strike asked.
"Well, it's ages ago now," said Irene.
Janice handed her a packet of indigestion tablets, which Irene took with a brief smile, but no thanks.
"But from what I remember..." She popped pills out of the blister pack. "Let me see, I want to get this right. It was very rude. It called Margot the C-word, I remember that, and said hellfire waited for women like her."
"Was it typed? Printed?"
"Written," said Irene.
She took a couple of tablets with a sip of tea.
"What about the second one?" said Strike.
"Oh, I don't know what that said. I had to go into her consulting room to give her a message, see, and I saw it lying on her desk. Same writing, I recognised it at once. She didn't like me seeing it, I could tell. Screwed it up and threw it in the bin."
Janice passed round fresh cups of tea and coffee. Irene helped herself to another chocolate biscuit.
"I doubt you'll know," said Strike, "but I wondered if you ever had any reason to suspect that Margot was pregnant before she..."
"How do you know about that?"
gasped Irene, looking thunderstruck.
"She was," said Robin.
"Yes," said Irene. "See? Jan, don't look like that, honestly. I took a call from a nursing home while she was out on a house call. They called the practice to confirm she'd be in next day." And she mouthed the next few words. "For an abortion."
"They told you what procedure she was going in for over the phone?" Robin asked.
For a moment, Irene looked rather confused.
I'm not proud of it, but I called the clinic back, just nosy. You do that kind of thing when you're young, don't you?"
Robin hoped her reciprocal smile looked sincerer than Irene's.
"When was this, Mrs. Hickson? Can you remember?" asked Strike.
"Not long before she disappeared. 4 weeks? Something like that.
Before or after the anonymous notes?"
"I don't... after, I think," said Irene. "Or was it... I can't remember.
Did you talk to anyone else about the appointment?"
"Only Jan, and she told me off, didn't you, Jan?" "I know you didn't mean any harm," muttered Janice. "But patient confidentiality... Margot wasn't our patient. It's a different thing."
"And you didn't tell the police about this?" Strike asked her.
"No," said Irene, "because I... well, I shouldn't have known, should I? Anyway, how could it have anything to do with her disappearing?"
"Apart from Mrs. Beatty, did you tell anyone else about it?"
"No," said Irene defensively, "because, I mean, I wouldn't have told anyone else. You keep your mouth shut working at a doctor's surgery. I could have told all kinds of people's secrets, couldn't I? Being a receptionist, I saw files, but of course you didn't say anything. I knew how to keep secrets. It was part of the job."
Expressionless, Strike wrote, "protesting too much," in his notebook.
"I've got another question, Mrs. Hickson, and it might be a sensitive one," Strike said, looking up again. "I heard you and Margot had a disagreement at the Christmas party."
"Oh," said Irene, her face falling. "That... yes, well..."
There was a slight pause.
"I was cross about what she'd done to Kevin, Jan's son. Remember, Jan?"
Janice looked confused.
"Come on, Jan, you do," said Irene, tapping Janice's arm again. "When she took him into her consulting room and blah, blah, blah." "Oh," said Janice.
For a moment, Robin had the distinct impression that Janice was truly cross with her friend this time.
"But you remember," said Irene, glaring at her. "I... yeah," said Janice. "Yeah, I was angry about that, all right."
"Jan had kept him off school," Irene told Strike.
"Hadn't you, Jan? How old was he? 6? And then? What exactly happened?"
Strike asked Janice.
"Kev had a tummy ache," said Janice. "Well, schoolitis, really. My neighbour, who sometimes looked after him, wasn't well."
"Basically," interrupted Irene, "Jan brought Kevin to work and..."
"Could Mrs. Beatty tell the story?"
Strike asked.
"Oh, yes, of course,"
said Irene. She put her hand back on her abdomen again and stroked it with a long, suffering air.
"Your usual childminder was ill," Strike prompted Janice.
"Yeah, but I was supposed to be at work, so I took Kev with me to the practice and give him a colouring book. Then I had to change a lady's dressing in the back room, so I put Kev in the waiting room. Irene and Gloria were keeping an eye on him for me. But then Margot, well, she took him into her consulting room and examined him, stripped him off to the waist and everything. She knew he was my son, and she knew why he was there. But she took it upon herself." "I was angry, I can't lie," said Janice quietly. "We had words. I said, all you had to do was wait until I'd seen the patient, and I'd have come in with him while you looked at him. And I've got to say, when I put it to her straight, she backed down right away and apologised."
"No," Janice said, because Irene had puffed herself up.
"She did, Irene. She apologised, said I was quite right. She shouldn't have seen him without me, but he'd been holding his tummy and she acted on instinct. It wasn't badly intentioned. She just sometimes put people's backs up, that's what I'm saying," said Irene. "Thought she was above everyone else. She knew best. Rushed in, I was going to say. But she were a good doctor," said Janice with quiet firmness. "You hear it all when you're in people's houses. You hear what the patients think of them. And Margot was well-liked. She took time. She was kind. She was, Irene. I know she got on your wick, but that's what the patients..." "Oh, well, maybe," said Irene, with an if-you-say-so inflection. "But she didn't have much competition at St. John's, did she?"
"Were Dr. Gupta and Dr. Brenner unpopular?" asked Strike.
"Dr. Gupta was lovely," said Janice. "A very good doctor, although some patients didn't want to see a brown man, and that's the truth. But Brenner was an hard man to like. It was only after he died that I understood why he might have..."
Irene gave a huge gasp, and then began, unexpectedly, to laugh.
Tell them what you collect, Janice. Go on."
She turned to Strike and Robin.
"If this isn't the creepiest, most morbid..." "I don't collect them," said Janice, who had turned pink. "They're just something I like to save. Obituaries. What do you think of that? The rest of us collect china or snow globes, blah, blah, blah. But Janice collects..." "It isn't a collection," repeated Janice, still pink-faced. "All it is..."
She addressed Robin with a trace of appeal.
"My mum couldn't read."
"Imagine," said Irene complacently, stroking her stomach. Janice faltered for a moment, then said,
"Yeah, so, Dad wasn't bothered about books, but he used to bring the paper home, and that's how I learned to read. I used to cut out the best stories, human interest, I suppose you'd call them. I've never been that interested in fiction. I can't see the point. Things somebody's made up." "Oh, I love a good novel," breathed Irene, still rubbing her stomach. "Anyway, I dunno. When you read an obituary, you find out who people have really been, don't you? If it's someone I know or I nursed, I keep them because, I dunno, I felt like somebody should. You get your life written up in the paper. It's an achievement, isn't it?"
"Not if you're Dennis Creed, it isn't," said Irene.
Looking as though she'd said something very clever, she reached forward to take another biscuit, and a deafening fart ripped through the room. Irene turned scarlet. Robin thought for one horrible moment that Strike was going to laugh, so she said loudly to Janice,
"Did you keep Dr. Brenner's obituary?" "Oh, yeah," said Janice, who seemed completely unperturbed by the loud noise that had just emanated from Irene. Perhaps she was used to far worse as a nurse. "And it explained a lot."
"In what way?" asked Robin, determinedly not looking at either Strike or Irene.
"He'd been into Bergen-Belsen, one of the first medical men in there."
"God," said Robin, shocked.
"I know," said Janice. "He never talked about it. I'd never have known if I hadn't read it in the paper. What he must have seen. Mounds of bodies, dead kids. I read a library book about it. Dreadful.
Maybe that's why he was the way he was, I don't know. I felt sorry when I read it. I hadn't seen him in years by the time he died. Someone showed me the obituary, knowing I'd been at St. John's, and I kept it as a record of him. You could forgive Brenner a lot, once you saw what he witnessed, what he'd been through. But that's true of everyone, really, isn't it? Once you know everything's explained. It's a shame you often don't know until it's too late to... Are you all right, love? She said to Irene.
In the wake of the fart, Robin suspected that Irene had decided the only dignified cover-up was to emphasise that she was unwell.
Do you know, I think it's stress, she said, her hand down the waistband of her trousers. It always flares up when I'm... Sorry, she said with dignity to Strike and Robin. But I'm afraid I don't think I...
Of course, said Strike, closing his notebook. I think we've asked everything we came for, anyway. Unless there is anything else, he asked the two women, that you've remembered that seems odd, in retrospect or out of place.
We've fought, haven't we? Janice asked Irene. All these years, we've talked about it, obviously.
It must have been Creed, mustn't it? Said Irene with finality. What other explanation is there? Where else could she have gone?
Do you think they'll let you in to see him? She asked Strike again, with a last flicker of curiosity.
No idea, he said, getting to his feet.
Thanks very much for your hospitality anyway, and for answering our questions.
Janice saw them out. Irene waved wordlessly as they left the room. Robin could tell that the interview had fallen short of her expectation of enjoyment. Awkward and uncomfortable admissions had been forced from her. The picture she'd painted of her young self had not been perhaps everything she would have wished. And nobody, Robin thought, shaking hands with Janice at the door, would particularly enjoy farting loudly in front of strangers.
Chapter 21 Well then, said Artigal, let it be tried. First in one balance set the true aside. He did so first, and then the false he laid in the other scale. Edmund Spenser, The Fairy Queen.
Well, I'm no doctor, said Strike, as they crossed the road back to the Land Rover, but I blame the curry.
Don't, said Robin, laughing against her will.
She couldn't help but feel a certain vicarious embarrassment.
You weren't sitting as near her as I was, said Strike, as he got back into the car. I'm guessing Lambooner.
Seriously, said Robin, half laughing, half disgusted. Stop!
As he drew his seatbelt back over himself, Strike said,
I need a proper drink.
There's a decent pub not far from here, said Robin. I looked it up, the Trafalgar Tavern. Looking up the pub was doubtless yet another nice thing that Robin had chosen to do for his birthday, and Strike wondered whether it was her intention to make him feel guilty. Probably not, he thought. But that, nevertheless, was the effect, so he passed no comment other than to ask,
What did you think of all that?
Well, there were a few cross-currents, weren't there? Said Robin, steering out of the parking space. And I think we were told a couple of lies.
Me too. Said Strike. Which ones did you spot?
Irene and Janice's row at the Christmas party, for starters, said Robin, turning out of Circus Street. I don't think it was really about Margot examining Janice's son, although I do think Margot examined Kevin without permission.
So do I, said Strike. But I agree. I don't think that's what the row was about. Irene forced Janice to tell that story because she didn't want to admit the truth. Which makes me wonder. Irene getting Janice to come to her house so we can interview them both together. Was that so Irene could make sure Janice didn't tell us anything she wouldn't want told? That's the trouble with friends you've had for decades, isn't it? They know too much.
Robin, who was busy trying to remember the route to the Trafalgar she'd memorized that morning, thought at once about all those stories Isla had told her